Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today we discuss perhaps the greatest 21st century miscarriage of justice in England and Wales, at least in numbers of those affected. The Post Office introduced a new computer system in 1999. All postmasters and mistresses were made to use this system to process transactions. But unfortunately, the system was riddled with glitches from the beginning, which meant that it inaccurately reported shortfalls in the funds of individual post offices, leading to these postmasters and mistresses being accused of fiddling the books by the post office itself. Today, to discuss this scandal, Rob Allen and I are joined by Paul Marshall, a barrister who represented three people who'd been accused by the post office, and Richard Moorhead, professor of law at Exeter University. Rob, you and I had both heard about this scandal, but it was kind of at the periphery of our vision. Having kind of thought about it, what are your top line thoughts?
It struck me reading up about this that surely people knew that there was something wrong here as it was going along. The scale of it, the lack of safeguards, it's almost like the scandal was hidden in plain sight.
Yep, agreed. Paul, at the heart of the scandal was this new computer system. What was wrong with it, and how did the post office masters and mistresses cope with the problems of it?
There were problems in the system from the word go. A postmaster would have a certain amount of takings that they would record on Horizon, and this information would be transmitted to the post office's main computer servers, which were maintained and operated by Fujitsu. Because of software problems, essentially bugs in the system, there would be a problem balancing what was said to have been received by a postmaster, or indeed paid out, and the record of that transaction held on the post office's servers. It was identified right at the outset, and it was known by the post office that there were teething problems. The way in which this was dealt with is that, not perhaps surprisingly, the post office wanted to protect itself against problems that would be thrown up by these bugs. And the solution devised, no doubt with the assistance of very high-priced lawyers, was that a postmaster who experienced a loss at their post office branch, they had to make up that discrepancy out of their own funds.
Richard, so what we had was postmasters and mistresses actually recording thousands and thousands of pounds of, as it were, losses, which they didn't think they'd lost. Is that the case?
Yeah, that seems to be the case. The computer system wasn't working properly and would tell them money was missing. And the post office would say, you have to pay this money. And they would say, well, it looks like there's something wrong with the computer system. And the helpline would say, well, you're the only people who appear to have problems with the computer system. Or they would say, we'll look into it, just pay the money and we'll see if it's sorted out, those sorts of things. And eventually, when the size of the alleged debts became really very large, the post office said, we think you've been stealing the money.
And up to about 1,000 ended up being criminally prosecuted, Richard, is that right?
Yeah, I think 900 plus prosecuted, of which 750 or so prosecuted successfully. Others will have been sued, other people were fired. So the numbers affected were significantly larger. We know about 2,500 or so postmasters claimed compensation from one of the compensation schemes recently.
And was it the most serious cases got prosecuted? What sort of sums were alleged to have been defrauded or taken from the post office?
Certainly in the tens of thousands quite often.
Yeah, anything from about 2,000 plus up to just short of £100,000.
Wow, yeah. And when people were convicted, What happened to them? Richard, do you know the figures?
A range of punishments. Dozens of people were sent to prison. First offences, but treated seriously as a breach of trust and a large sum of money, and the kind of notional idea that they were somehow stealing people's pensions, infecting, if you like, the decision-making process by which they were then carted off to prison, having been, you know, previously upstanding members of the community.
I mean, Paul, do you know, I mean, of the 750-odd that were convicted, do you know how many went to prison out of that number?
No, I don't know that off the top of my head, but of the 550 who engaged in the civil litigation called the Bates litigation, some 66 of those had been convicted and in most cases imprisoned. But there's an angle to this which I think needs to be emphasised, and that's the post office rollout of its Horizon system coincided exactly with some recommendations made to Parliament by the Law Commission. And these recommendations had the effect that it became the obligation of somebody prosecuted by the post office, or indeed subject to civil proceedings, to show what was wrong with the post office computer system. Until then, if you relied on evidence from a computer, you had to show that the computer was working properly at the relevant time. Now, Parliament abolished that rule with the effect that, for instance, Mrs. Misra, one of my clients, was prosecuted for allegedly having stolen £70,000. And at her trial, the prosecuting counsel said to the jury, well, Mrs. Misra says she has a problem with her Horizon system, but she can't tell you what it is. Well, of course, the problem confronting somebody who is prosecuted on the basis of computer evidence from a very large network system of this kind is that they simply cannot identify what the problem was. And the post office could identify it, but in its prosecutions, it repeatedly gave evidence to the court that it knew of no problems with Horizon, and insofar as there were any, those had been fixed. Well, that was simply untrue.
I'd like to kind of focus on the human story so people understand kind of what actual impact these kind of prosecutions had on people and their families. Richard, what kind of human harm did these prosecutions do, as well as financial harm?
So we've done a bit of research on the levels of mental health problems 20 years later, and people are still suffering very high levels of anxiety and depression. These have really scarred people's lives. They carry the sense of injustice that they have been powerless against the post office and the criminal justice system. People like Lee Castleton, who actually wasn't prosecuted, was labelled a thief in his own community. So any of you who've got teenage kids can probably imagine the horror of your kids coming back from school, having been spat on and being told that their dad's a thief. You know, that kind of trauma I don't think really goes away. One of Paul's clients was sent to prison and was doing the tea round and opened the cell door to give tea to one of the prisoners and found somebody hanging in the cell.
I'll jump in on that if I may. Tracy Felstead was a post office counter clerk at the age of 19, having not long before left school. She repeatedly experienced small amounts of money misbalancing at her till. She was reassured many times that this was all right, and so long as it was picked up, it would all be rectified and will be smoothed out in due course. She went on holiday, and she returned from her holiday and was taken aside and told that there was missing from her till £3,000. She was visited by post office investigators, subject to hostile interviewing, in the course of which she was asked if she could explain how she didn't steal the money. Quote, her family raised the money that was alleged to be missing and paid it over to the post office, and she was prosecuted for theft. She had an expert who attended court to assist her, who asked the post office a whole series of questions and requested a large amount of information. They said that it would cost about £20,000 or thereabouts to provide that information. He wasn't actually called at her trial, so she was on her own. She was convicted of theft. She was imprisoned in Holloway Prison. And She suffered catastrophic mental health issues as a result. She found a cellmate hanging in her cell, and she always protested her innocence. The impact of these convictions on innocent people is catastrophic and life-changing.
And can I just remark, to have a prison sentence for your first offence of theft is pretty rare and extremely punitive compared to most sentencing.
Yeah, I guess the legal justification would have been these were quite sizable sums of money and it was a breach of trust type offence. But given the nature of the people, not to mention the fact that actually they were innocent, it does seem extraordinary that so many people were sentenced to prison immediately.
Isn't it the case that quite a few of the people involved actually ended up pleading guilty to one charge or another, even though they hadn't done anything wrong? How did that come about?
Well, so the main story there is that at various points they were put under pressure either to tell a story consistent with their guilt, so to make a kind of a false confession, or to plead guilty to one of the lesser charges on the charge sheet. So the kind of typical approach was to charge these people with both theft and false accounting. It was easier to prove the false accounting charge. So they were advised by their lawyers to accept the plea to false accounting on the basis that they probably would not go to prison. And as the Court of Appeal said in the Hamilton appeal judgments, they felt like they had to accept that advice. Some of them did go to prison, I think, anyway. But I think many of them would have avoided prison as a result of that.
Hindsight's a difficult thing, but that doesn't seem very good advice from the defence lawyers to do that.
I think it was a sense of helplessness. It's exactly what happened to Janet Skinner, my client, who was advised to plead guilty to false accounting on the advice that that might well avoid a custodial sentence. So she did plead guilty to false accounting, was imprisoned anyway. The reason why lawyers advise clients to plead guilty is that they simply had no means of being able to identify that there was a problem with the Horizon system, because all that information was kept from them by the post office.
But Richard, we are talking here about people who, even if they didn't understand the intricacies of the computer system, didn't actually think that they were guilty of the crime, but pleading guilty.
Well, one of the ways that the false accounting charges were accepted is that people were faced with Horizon saying there is £8,000 missing, and what they would do temporarily while they tried to work out what had happened, the postmasters now, is kind of cover that up. And the post office treated that as dishonesty. And some of the sub-postmasters felt like that they had, in a way, been a bit dishonest in covering it up. And so they felt like, well, they had done something wrong and therefore maybe they had committed the criminal offence.
Can I just make a commercial point? The problem for the post office was that it had a computer system that was essentially unreliable. And it knew that it had persistent problems with balancing accounts for postmasters. Now, if that became public knowledge, the inescapable conclusion would be that its computer system didn't work. That had massive consequences potentially for the post office, both commercially and for preventing fraud, because if it was known that it couldn't tell the difference between fraud and the system not working, the entire post office business model effectively collapsed. So the post office had to maintain the fiction that the post office Horizon system was a reliable computer system. And the way in which it chose to do that was by bringing civil proceedings against people like Lee Castleton. The post office spent £321,000 bringing that claim, as a result of which Lee Castleton became bankrupt. The judgment in that case concluded that Horizon was working perfectly. That was an enormously valuable judgment for the post office, because they could wave it in front of other potential defendants and say, we've got a high court judgment where the judge says the system's reliable. And what happens in 2021, tracking forward, when the appeal is granted, is the Court of Appeal's decision torpedoes the post office business model and ultimately renders it effectively insolvent.
One of the, to me anyway, unusual aspects of this case is that the criminal prosecutions weren't undertaken by the Crown Prosecution Service. They were undertaken by the post office itself as a kind of private prosecution. I mean, Richard, what do you think of that? Did it make any material difference if these cases had been given to the CPS to take forward? Would they have gone forward?
Well, I don't think it's the only thing that's going on here, but clearly the fact that the post office had a commercial interest in using criminal proceedings to recover money, so it was partly a debt recovery mechanism, and they were used as a vehicle, as Paul says, to protect the reputation of Horizon and the post office. So all of those things would have had an influence on the way the post office conducted cases, which wouldn't have been influential on the CPS, for instance. The CPS would have had no incentive to seek plea deals whereby the defendants would not mention Horizon in their plea of mitigation. So some of these plea deals, a further condition the post office required was, by the way, when you admit your guilt and seek a low sentence from the judge, you must not say that Horizon was part of the problem, that the computer system was not working properly. And the lawyers for these sub-postmasters, sub-postmistresses agreed to that condition, which helped keep the problem quiet.
So basically, we're talking about defendants being gagged?
Yeah, in the plea of mitigation, that's correct.
Can I just ask a brief question about disclosure? I know it's a technical issue, but if a prosecutor has some information that might be useful to the defence, they're obliged to make that available to the defence, are they not? Paul, what do you think on that?
There is an obligation on the part of the prosecutor absolutely to disclose any material or information it has available that may assist in defending the claim. I think the most shocking example of this is that Fujitsu and the post office had a very high-level meeting in which they discussed a bug that they described as the receipts and payments mismatch bug. And it was recorded in a formal document that the effect of this bug would be that a postmaster would believe that their accounts at their Horizon terminal were balancing, where in fact they would not be balancing. Now, this was circulated amongst senior lawyers in the post office and indeed others in about September 2010. Now, Mrs. Misra was prosecuted in October 2010, and no mention of this bug and its effects was made. And had it been, it would have fundamentally undermined the prosecution case, because prosecuting counsel both opened and closed the case on the basis that any problem with Horizon would be evident or apparent to a post office branch Horizon terminal operator. And that was simply untrue. And it was known by the post office to be untrue at the time of her prosecution.
So, Paul, do you think that the fact that the post office was privately prosecuting this was a fundamental problem?
It was an absolutely massive problem, because the post office wasn't just prosecuting. Firstly, it was the alleged victim. Secondly, it was the investigator. And thirdly, it was the prosecutor. Well, that's multiple crisscrossing of interests, and also a sort of concentration of interests in one entity, namely the post office. A really shocking aspect to this is that routinely, post office branch managers who'd experienced these shortfalls were told that they were the only ones who had experienced this kind of problem. Now, that was simply a lie. Legally, it was a misrepresentation in order to cause and encourage the postmaster concerned to A, feel vulnerable, and B, to make concessions and accept things when otherwise they might well not have done so.
So does that mean that the postmasters didn't know that other postmasters were also being prosecuted?
Yeah, absolutely. When Alan Bates started to get the group litigation, the civil litigation, together, they couldn't believe that so many people had similar experiences, because they all thought, and they were all told at the time, you're on your own.
Richard, it was a group litigation case that we've referred to, led by Mr. Bates, which actually uncovered the problems with Horizon. But previously, Some of the people who'd been sued and prosecuted had in fact appealed their cases, as Paul mentioned. What went wrong with the system that it costs $46 million in a big group litigation case to uncover what really happened, and these previous appeals didn't uncover any of it?
It's a really good question. There are two main things. One is that there was a judge, if you like, of singular skill and persistence, Mr. Justice Fraser. He was really willing to engage with a very detailed case and take a line in deciding the case, which was very challenging to the post office. He, if you like, brooked no nonsense. And it was his decision, based on the evidence that he heard, which, if you like, created an appalling vista of evidence being given that was misleading and evidence being suppressed and so on and so forth. So I think that made a really big difference. The second thing was that it became clear that there was a wealth of evidence which nobody apart from the post office and Fujitsu, and I'm afraid I should emphasize their lawyers, knew about, which was consistent with the picture that they knew or ought to have known that they prosecuted these people improperly. And the Court of Appeal in the Hamilton case comes very close to saying that they acted in bad faith.
And Paul, you've written about a kind of, and you've mentioned it already, this fundamental failing as you see it in the law of evidence now about computers. And in particular, you've been critical of judges' understanding of how computers work and how computer glitches work. Do you think that was one of the main reasons why some, at least, of these earlier appeals failed to make much headway?
Yes, I do. I think there's a huge technical deficit in the understanding of the kind of evidence derived from computer systems. And the mask came off for the post office on this in the Horizon Issues trial in 2019, when the 550 claimants said, well, we want to see what's called the known error log. Remember, this is 20 years after the rollout of the Horizon system. And the post office's answer to this was, well, we're not sure that any such record exists. When it was shown to exist, the post office said, well, we don't think it's relevant. When it was shown to be relevant, the post office said, well, we don't have it. It's Fujitsu who has it. Now, tracking back to what I was saying about Tracy Felstead, this was what Michael Turner was after in his request to Fujitsu and the post office. They weren't going to give it to him, and they said it was too expensive. In 2019, when Mr. Justice Fraser identified that not only did it exist and that it was relevant and the post office was contractually entitled to it, it disclosed hundreds of thousands of records of bugs, errors, fixes over the entire life of the Horizon system. And this was held by Fujitsu for the entire life of the Horizon system, but it was only disclosed 20 years after it had been rolled out. The point is, judges and lawyers don't know about a known error log.
Do you think that more lower-level court back in 2000 with Mrs. Misra ought to have insisted on that evidence being made available to her expert witness, or was that unrealistic?
Yes. Professor McLaughlin, in Mrs. Misra's trial, he was her expert. He was a computer specialist. He said, I'm unable to assist the court and give full evidence until I've seen the error records maintained by the post office. And the judge, I think he refused four applications for disclosure of Horizon documents to Mrs. Misra, and her defence counsel said Mrs. Misra cannot have a fair trial without this disclosure. And the judge responded by saying, well, there's been a lot of technical disclosure and the trial is fair. Well, it took another 10 years for the Court of Appeal to say there hadn't been proper disclosure and her trial was unfair.
Richard, I mean, that smacks of complacency, it has to be said. One of the tragedies of the post office cases was that many postmasters lost significant amounts of money, including becoming bankrupt. Has that miscarriage of justice been rectified, the amount of money they lost?
No, that's being looked at now. So there are three compensation schemes which are supposed to be compensating the sub-postmasters for losses that arose as a result of the Horizon problems.
So years down the line, people are still way out of pocket for what the post office did.
Yeah, it's only really being dealt with now because it's recognised that the prosecutions were so appallingly handled. Ordinarily, this would not have been dealt with. It's because there's been such a stink in the aftermath of the Bates case and the Hamilton case. The main scheme, the HSS scheme, which is administered by the Post Office and its firm of solicitors, Herbert Smith Freehills, is currently the subject of a great deal of controversy, and the statutory inquiry will be looking at whether the compensation payments offered and granted in those cases has been fair a little bit later in the year. So this is a story that will run for some time yet, I'm afraid.
I mean, Paul Richards mentioned this inquiry, the Wynne Williams inquiry, which is quite a big investigation, I think, substantially into what went wrong with the computer and at the post office end, but also the judicial and legal and other failings. Is that right? Has it got the terms of reference to grapple with the kind of issues that we've been talking about today?
It initially was incepted really as an investigation as to what went wrong in the post office with Horizon. But I think it's fair to say that Sir Wynne Williams has become increasingly interested in what went wrong procedurally and legally. And not long ago, I think it was in May, he said that he was concerned to know and to find out who knew what when and what was done with that knowledge.
Richard, most of the publicity up until now has been about the failures of the post office rather than about the justice system as a whole. Is that because the justice system problems are too uncomfortable to face?
I think there is a measure of truth in that. I mean, we would recognise problems of defence representation. We would recognise problems of overcharging, of inappropriate plea bargaining, of courts not really scrutinising cases in the way that they ought to, of the appeal courts not being keen to overturn convictions. This is a particularly stark example of those kinds of problems being manifest against hundreds and hundreds of very palpably innocent people. It'll be interesting to see if that's something the inquiry starts to grapple with. I think the inquiry is more interested in who did what and when, as Paul said, and that includes the way the cases were prosecuted by the lawyers, and it includes things like the private prosecution by the post office. But I do think you're right. It does ask broader questions about whether the criminal justice as it's currently operating is fit for purpose.
Yeah. Well, what was happening? People were routinely being convicted of offences of which they were innocent on wholly duff, incomplete and misleading evidence. Well, what does that tell you about the criminal justice system? Well, it shows that in all those instances, it simply didn't work. Part of the problem is, I think, the criminal justice system, the justice system as a whole, has a very great interest in maintaining public confidence. And explicit recognition of this kind of whole-scale failure is not only embarrassing, but it basically cuts at public confidence in the justice system. And so there is a sort of institutional drag, resistance, friction, whatever you like, in accepting and recognising that very important and very serious things have gone wrong in multiple ways.
There have been a sizable number. I think I saw 40 plus as a figure mentioned this week of people who have sought to appeal Horizon-related convictions recently and been unsuccessful. So there's a live problem as well as the problem of the people who have, if you like, gone before.
Yeah. I think we should draw things to a close. It's been a fascinating discussion on a complex but, you know, very troubling episode that, as you say, is still being written to an extent. Can I ask each of you, if you were Lord Chancellor and you could make one change that you think might help to prevent this sort of calamity happening again, what would that one change be? Paul, can I start with you?
I would urge Parliament to require that prosecutors relying on computer evidence as a basis for the prosecution should be required to prove that the computer from which the information is derived is working properly. Had that been required in these prosecutions, the post office in no case could have given honest evidence that it was.
Okay, and Richard?
If I had to settle on one issue, I would say the approach to disclosure is plainly not working in criminal cases. And a number of very sensible criminal practitioners are saying, actually, all unused materials should be available to the defence and they can search through it as they choose to. And of course, that would have to be properly resourced.
Rob, what about you? If you were Lord Chancellor, what one change?
Well, I'm a bit concerned about this private prosecution point. I would prefer to see cases going through public prosecutors because, you know, at the end of the day, it's the state, the Crown, who is responsible for prosecuting criminal law, or should be. I'm troubled that there are such a variety of possibilities for private prosecutions. I think that needs looking at.
Thanks, Rob. And for more information, do refer as ever to our programme notes and let us know if you've got any ideas for other podcasts. Thanks very much indeed, Paul Marshall and Richard Moorhead. And I'll say goodbye.
Thank you all. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Bye-bye.